We're talking about a group of Black physicians who are advocating for communities of color as clinical trials are underway for a COVID-19 vaccine. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Physician Task Force, it wants to ensure that emerging vaccines and treatments will be trusted in communities that have been marginalized in our country's healthcare system, and that they're not left behind as vaccine development moves quickly. Have you had access to a COVID test? Can you get primary care? Will you trust a vaccine when it becomes available? And do you think you'll have access to it? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Dial Hewlett Jr. is an infectious disease specialist and a member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Task Force on Vaccines and Therapeutics. He's medical director of the Disease Control Division and deputy commissioner at the Westchester County Department of Health in New York. Dr. Hewlett, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, tell us about this task force and how you got involved with it.
Yes, the task force that was put together was mainly organized by members of the National Medical Association, President Dr. Leon McDougall, and some of the past presidents. There was deep concern regarding the process by which a vaccine for COVID-19 was being developed. There was concern that the process might be rushed. There was concern that there might be shortcuts, which would in many ways or possibly have a negative impact on the safety of the product. And for that reason, we felt that it was very important for us to understand the process by which the data was being analyzed and to be able to look at it ourselves as a group of African-American physicians. And at the end of the day, we're all very optimistic that there's going to be a successful vaccine, and we want to be able to assure members of our communities around the country that the vaccine is in fact going to be effective and safe based upon our own review of the information.
Of the literature, yeah. How will the group operate? How will you handle the data?
Well, that is something that we are still trying to go through. One of the suggestions is that we actually approach the individual manufacturers as they are completing their applications and as the applications are being submitted. We are hoping that they will consent to having an advisory session with us to review some of the summaries of the case of the reports, to review some of the summaries of the safety and efficacy so that we can have an in-depth understanding of this. This is our hope, and we're hoping that this can occur as the FDA is reviewing the applications.
One of the goals is to bridge the trust gap between the federal government and the other, the CDC and the FDA and underserved communities like Black communities and Latinx communities. What does mistrust of the government and the medical establishment look like for these communities of color?
Well, communities of color, as you probably know, are very heterogeneous. There are certain segments of the population that are very distrustful. And some of this goes back historically to the Tuskegee experiments, where individuals were actually denied access to known treatments. There certainly are other reasons for distrust as well, as we look at some of the disparities which have surfaced during this pandemic. And so I think that that's one of the reasons why we as the National Medical Association and other individuals, other African-American physicians feel that we need to be able to look at this and to be able to serve as trusted messengers, if you will, for our communities.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Dial Hewlett, who is an infectious disease specialist and a member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 community. Are you concerned that the COVID-19 vaccine won't reach your community? When a vaccine becomes available, will you get it? Have you been able to get primary care amid the pandemic? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Hewlett, let's look closer at clinical studies that are underway for a vaccine. There was a study out of UC San Francisco that found that trial participants, that they don't reflect the populations that COVID-19 has hit the hardest. Can you tell us more about why diversity is important in clinical trials and what you see going on in for COVID vaccine?
Yes, certainly. This has been a problem that has been going on for a very long time. And it is very important to have a cross-section, if you will, of the population involved in clinical trials. We know that in some situations, individuals from different ethnic groups, different races may respond differently. We know that it's important to try to include a good cross-section so that when the product is approved for use, we can be assured that it has been essentially evaluated in members of the community who are represented just universally. One of the problems with clinical trials is that we have a lack of representation of investigators who are investigators of color, members of the African-American and Latinx communities. Part of the reason is that in order to conduct some of these large trials, you have to have resources, and most of those resources are found in our large academic centers. And as a result of that, this really actually defines the population that you are going to be capturing at the very beginning. And so there's an effort on the part of our group, as well as others, to try to engage individuals of color to serve as investigators so that we'll be able to recruit individuals from the various communities that are underrepresented.
What is the role of these investigators? What do they do?
Well, investigators are the ones who actually coordinate and organize the enrollment of subjects into the clinical trials. And so they have to have a setup at their clinics or at their hospitals so that they can accommodate the individuals who come in. They have to have a way of recruiting. They actually have to have a staff. And so in order to be effective, you have to have a research coordinator. You have to have usually a dedicated pharmacist. You will have to have oftentimes nurses or nurse practitioners who will be able to obtain what we call informed consent from the individuals to explain to them the benefits, the potential benefits, and the risks. And so it is a rather complex process, and it does require a lot of time and dedication. The investigators are, for the most part, going to be physicians. Sometimes they may be infectious disease physicians, or they may be physicians with other specialties.
I'm wondering, you know, fast-tracking a COVID vaccine and the FDA's emergency use authorizations, that's been controversial. Do you have concerns over rapid rollout and transparency in the vaccine approval process as it relates to communities of color?
Yes, we do. And that's the main reason why the task force was formed. We had concerns about the rapid rollout. We actually believe at the end of the day, there is going to be an effective and safe vaccine, probably more than one that will be available in a short period of time. But we feel that in order for individuals in our communities to be willing to accept the vaccine, they will have to have assurance from a group like ours that it is effective and safe for them to use.
The National Medical Association has organized this committee that we're talking about with infectious disease specialist Dale Hewlett, who is on this task force on vaccines and therapeutics. You can join in. Do you think this oversight matters for patients of color? Do you think your community is reflected in the trials, in the data coming out on COVID? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, we're discussing a new task force led by physicians of color aimed at addressing concerns about emerging COVID-19 vaccines and treatments. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So this committee is advocating, as we've been talking about, for more Black and brown people to be included in clinical trials. And the trial process, the group aims to develop trust for vaccines and treatments and make sure that Black and Latino and Native American communities have access to this care, given the fact that they have been hit much harder by this pandemic. Will you trust a vaccine when it becomes available? And do you think you'll have access to it? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Dial Hewlett is an infectious disease specialist and a member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee. And Dr. Hewlett stays with us. Let's take a call now. Rosa is joining us from Waterford this morning. Hi, Rosa.
Hello, good morning. I work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm very fortunate to meet some amazing minds. And in the past week, I've met two microbiologists just in passing and asked both of them, would you take the COVID vaccine? And both said no. They told me it's because the COVID virus is changing, just like a flu virus. It changes. Therefore, the vaccine won't. It's just going to be hit or miss, just like a flu vaccine. And they also added that in the future, the COVID virus will just be like a flu virus. We'll have to deal with it every year.
Dr. Hewlett, how would you respond to Rosa there and, you know, the trust in a vaccine?
Yes. Well, thank you very much for that question. And I totally understand the sentiments that are being expressed. This is a new virus. And so we really don't know exactly how it's going to behave in years to come. One of the things that we do know is that it would be important for us to have a vaccine, even if it is something that might have to be repeated every year or every 2 years, just as we do with influenza. We are hoping that that won't be the case, but we really have no way to know for sure. One of the things that you have brought out is very important, that we are trying to gain trust. We're trying to obtain information that is going to educate us in terms of this vaccine and the protection that it is going to give, and what is the duration of the protection. So I think in many cases, certainly an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, if you will.
African Americans have died from COVID at over twice the rate of white people. What particular challenges do you see that Black communities face when it comes to COVID exposure, obtaining treatment, and what is happening in the community?
Well, this is something that, again, these disparities have existed for a very, very long time. And just to highlight this, I think for some of your listeners, I think it's important for people to know that if you look at the early experience in a place like in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, one of the things that was noted back in April was that Blacks in Milwaukee comprised about 26% of the population, yet they represented nearly half of the cases that were reported, and they represented 80% of the deaths. One of the problems I think that we face, in addition to limited access to healthcare, is that there are crowded living conditions. And we know that if people are living in multi-generational facilities, that they are more likely to contract this, and that it is more difficult for them to be on quarantine or isolation if we have an infection within a household. Likewise, one of the things that we found from some of the research that we've done is that a disproportionate percentage of African Americans and Latinx communities work in occupations where they are considered first line workers.
So essential workers
who cannot, yes, essential workers, that's correct. So they cannot work from home as some of the other communities can. And so this also has been a contributing factor. And then finally, the other contributing factor is the existence of comorbidities. So uncontrolled hypertension, obesity, chronic respiratory disease, these are all things which predispose individuals to morbidity and to possibly death from this. And part of the reason why these things are so prevalent, or at least part of the reason, is that there may be a lack of access to healthcare in our communities.
We're talking with Dr. Dial Hewlett, who is an infectious disease specialist and a member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee. It's aimed at safeguarding and vetting vaccines and treatments for communities of color, with marginalized people at the forefront of concern as we look at these new treatments for COVID. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Hewlett, as you lay this out, you know, these inequities and the systemic racism and the structures of our healthcare system can't be fixed immediately, but communities can take steps in the right direction. What would you tell public health departments that are trying to get their arms around COVID and governments as they look at how to be more inclusive?
Well, one of the things that we are doing at our health department, that is, since I work for a health department, is we are trying to place an emphasis on education. One of our main jobs, in addition to the prevention of the spread of illness, is also to educate people on how they can prevent illness and limit illness from occurring. And so educating the public is one of the major things that we want to do. We want to make sure that we are putting out factual, objective information for people. We want to make sure that we are combating what we call misinformation or disinformation. We know that we already have problems with skepticism in regard to vaccines. We've had recent outbreaks of the measles, which is something that is totally preventable and probably can be eradicated. However, we have a lot of members and segments of our community that are skeptical about giving their children the various vaccines. And so it's an uphill battle, but it is something that I think that we and the health departments can do. And again, circling back to our own task force, the NMA task force, we feel that this is something that we have to do for our community to make sure that we are trying to make sure that they have accurate, objective information and making sure that we're combating the disinformation and propaganda that might be circulating about various things having to do with this pandemic.
How do you approach the concern around people being afraid to get a test because they fear they may lose their job if they find that they have COVID?
This is a big concern. And all that we can really do, and in our health department, of course, there are regulations and laws, and we can actually work with employers to make sure that they are treating individuals fairly. So when a person is ordered to be on quarantine, by law, by healthcare law, they really should not be fired from their job because they have to be on quarantine. So in health departments, at least in our own, we issue statements so that individuals can provide that to the employers so that they know that they are ordered to be on either isolation or quarantine. But this is certainly a very legitimate concern that people have. And unfortunately, a lot of the members of our community work for employers who are not as subject to following the guidelines and rules.
Are you seeing at all where you are that the capacity for testing is there, but there aren't nearly the number of tests being done that they're, but the testing capacity far exceeds demand?
Well, it's really a twofold kind of a situation. In our underserved communities, we continue to have a lack of access to testing.
Okay.
There's a problem in terms of the timing of the testing. And so with our gold standard test that we've been doing, oftentimes it may take 3 or 4 days before the person gets the result. In many of our communities, people have to rely on public transportation because they cannot get to the actual sites. That's not necessarily the same in some of our more affluent communities. So I think we certainly need more testing. That is clear. We have to make sure that people understand that it's a good thing to have the test done if you have been exposed or if you actually are ill with symptoms that are suggestive of COVID-19.
Very quickly, let's bring in Matt in Nisida. Hi, Matt. Are you there? And Matt is not there. Matt wants to know, have hospitals outside of New York been overwhelmed anywhere? What have you seen?
Well, our community in Westchester, we were actually at the epicenter of the outbreak. Yeah. We're about 30 miles north of New York City. And during the peak of the outbreak, our hospitals were being essentially overwhelmed, if you will, with the number of cases. And so it wasn't just in New York City. We had similar problems in our county. There were similar problems in neighboring Nassau County. There were also similar problems in some of the communities that were close to New York and New Jersey. And you're seeing the same things now all over the country. So hopefully, if we are able to get a better handle on things, we can prevent that from occurring moving forward. That is one of the other reasons why we are desperately trying to encourage everyone to accept the influenza vaccine, because as you know, influenza is one of the important things that causes people to enter the emergency rooms and to be admitted into the hospitals. And so if we can limit that, it will be very helpful in keeping the beds freed.
Dr. Hewlett, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Dial Hewlett Jr. is part of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Task Force on Vaccines and Therapeutics, and he is an alumnus, by the way, of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up, we talk with a UW-Madison researcher involved in the effort to get a saliva test. It's after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're discussing saliva-based tests that show promise for widespread COVID-19 monitoring and efforts underway to advance this form of testing at UW-Madison. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If you want to know if you're infected with the COVID-19 virus, there are a couple types of tests, molecular and antigen testing, and these tests are done with a nasal or a throat swab. But a test detecting the virus in saliva could make testing easier and expand capacity. Would you prefer a saliva test to a nasal swab? What do you want to know about the reagents and how the testing works on your spit? It's 800-642-1234. Dave O'Connor is a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW-Madison. He's leading a project using saliva samples to test for COVID. David, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, as of last month, the FDA had authorized the use of saliva as a sample for testing in 5 different tests now. What are you working on?
So we're working on a type of non-diagnostic test that could be likened to a fancy fever check. So if you go into a building and you they stick one of those thermometers up against your forehead, and if you have a fever, they might not let you in. And we're working on a testing version of that where you would give some saliva if you show up at a school and they would test the saliva. And if it shows that you might have coronavirus genetic material in the saliva, they'd say, well, you know, this doesn't mean that you're infected, but it means that you should probably go home and get a follow-up diagnostic test. And so this is what we call non-diagnostic testing. And its real advantage is that it can be done outside of conventional laboratory settings.
Okay, so this is a kind of a form of triage, if you will.
Exactly. We know that we need to get more testing into schools. And unfortunately, most schools don't have, you know, molecular biology labs in them. And so the sort of, licensed diagnostic testing that you currently get if you go to, say, the Alliant Energy Center here in Madison isn't going to be available there. So we're trying to bring the testing to where it's needed.
You know, the cost and access to these labs, to the reagents, it's all been an issue. Do you anticipate supply shortages if saliva tests come on strong? I'm thinking about the vial you spit into.
Well, I think that, you know, that's always going to be an issue is supply chain. But, you know, we for our saliva test, use a very simple, small piece of plastic. I've never thought about there being a limit on plastic straws that you can get at McDonald's, and I don't think there's any reason why you would necessarily have limits on simple plastic tubes either.
So when you spit into the plastic tube and you hand it over, what happens?
So after you spit into a plastic tube, we have someone heat up the sample so that it inactivates the virus. And then after that virus is inactivated, any sample that had virus in it, it's safe to handle. Someone then adds a couple of chemicals to it, heats it up again for another half an hour. And then there's a color change from pink to yellow if there's evidence for genetic material for the virus in the sample. And so we just look at it and say, okay, well, this sample turned yellow, so this individual should be notified that they might be infected and should isolate and get a follow-up diagnostic test.
But meanwhile, you know, that person can't be standing outside for a half hour waiting for that initial triage sample to come back. You know, how would you approach this test?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So what we've been doing since we started in July is having people provide consent to volunteer for our testing and then provide the saliva on site. And then we test it, and a couple hours later, we would notify a physician to contact people if anyone needed to be contacted. We're just starting this week working towards something where people can just drop a sample off in a Dropbox and get notified a couple of hours later. So we're looking to reduce that days-long delay that often happens when you submit a sample to, like, Exact Sciences or one of the other diagnostic testing companies to a couple of hours. But then the next generation of tests is hopefully going to reduce it further to, like, 15 minutes. We're not there yet, but we still think that several hours is better than several days.
And how long can that spit specimen stay active and be, a good specimen?
Yeah, so I've learned more about spit than I thought I'd ever know this summer. And it turns out that virus is quite stable in spit, and it can actually be pretty stable at room temperature for up to, 5 days or so. So if someone collects a sample at night and then drops the sample in a Dropbox for us the next morning, it should be totally fine.
Matt from Wausau emailed to ask, how many tests a day would be effective to slow the growth and spread of COVID-19?
That's a great question. And the answer is it's a massive, massive number. Right now, when we have so much virus in our communities, we would need to be testing places like schools multiple times a week. And that's going to be a really expensive proposition. And you need to be talking probably about billions of tests nationwide if we were serious about trying to test our way out of the epidemic. What we think is that this is where testing at the point of need is most important. So if you needed to do those billions of tests, as good as our diagnostics laboratory system is, there's no way that any diagnostic lab system can handle that sort of influx of samples. What you need to do is you need to borrow a lesson from other sorts of infectious disease responses in places like sub-Saharan Africa, where, we've been working on HIV for a long, long time. And you need to work on task shifting so that the testing can be performed by people who are less skilled. So instead of trying to say, well, how do you have a billion places or a billion tests performed a week in centralized labs, you instead ask, can you have, a million people performing 100 tests or 1,000 tests a week by training a cadre of people who, aren't necessarily skilled laboratory workers to perform very simple tests without a lot of training. And so that's sort of the model that we're hoping to work towards, is one where you have, tests that are performed by people who are not skilled molecular virologists, but rather just have the ability to follow, simple recipes and be really meticulous.
We're talking with Dave O'Connor, who is a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW-Madison. He's leading a COVID-19 non-diagnostic saliva testing, and we're getting his insights at 800-642-1234, taking your questions as well. So, Dave, I understand that you're running outdoor testing stations in Madison, as you said, which involves gear being loaded and unloaded from a minivan. What is this van? What is the equipment like? And how are you moving it around?
Yeah, it's a UW-Madison branded Dodge van that we can shove all the laboratory gear in the back of. And again, this gets to this idea of having simple tests that don't require the sort of fancy, you know, laboratory, you know, equipment that you might see in like a CSI show, but instead just requires a couple of card tables, a couple of, you know, heating ovens, and a test that you can read by just looking at it. And I want to emphasize that this sort of test is a stopgap to what's likely going to be coming either later this year or early next year, where you're going to have what's been called antigen testing, where it's the same sort of idea, except it hopefully will be even easier, like doing a home pregnancy test, where you'll collect a sample, you'll apply it to a card, and then the card will change colors or have a couple of bands appear when a sample is positive. Our test is sort of a primitive version of that that still requires a little bit more hands-on manipulation. But the advantage is that the sort of testing we have is available today, and those antigen tests are just now starting to be distributed. And so we can learn lessons about how to use this sort of testing now that we can bring to those antigen tests once they become more widely available.
What do your numbers show? How sensitive is your test in detecting virus?
Yeah, so we've run more than 2,500 tests in the Madison area since July, and we've had that about 15 people get that unpleasant call from one of the physicians on our study saying, you really need to go isolate and potentially get a diagnostic test. And I think that 15 into 2,500 illustrates, you know, two important things. The first is that most of the time, most people who feel fine are in fact fine. So, you know, if you don't feel sick, you go to school, you're not sick. It also indicates that a test that has even a small number of positives is probably going to have false positives when you have a relatively low prevalence in whatever community is that you're testing. So of those 15, about half of them turned out to be true positives when people went to get diagnostic tests, and the other 7 or 8 people ended up being false positives. So of course we're working on that, trying to improve the true positive rate, but we need to be understanding of the fact that as we deploy these tests at scale, you know, you're going to miss some people, but you'd rather get the people who are highly contagious outside, out of schools or out of workplaces, even if it means that a couple of people are inconvenienced with potentially false positives. You know, I would be the first to admit that our testing is not perfect, but I think it sure beats the alternative where there is no testing on a routine basis for non-symptomatic people in schools and workplaces, which is what we have if we don't have some form of testing like this.
We have UW-Madison pathology professor Dave O'Connor with us as we look at the rollout of this saliva testing for COVID-19 that shows promise for greatly being able to expand capacity. Have you been tested for COVID-19? Have you taken a saliva-based test, or have you volunteered for one? What was it like? Would you be more apt to take a test if it were saliva-based? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dave O'Connor here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with UW-Madison pathologist Dave O'Connor. He's leading a COVID-19 saliva testing project that is working on a less invasive, more cost-effective way to test for COVID that is non-diagnostic. FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn said last month in a statement that processing saliva samples to test for COVID-19 infection is groundbreaking in terms of efficiency and avoiding shortages of crucial test components like reagents. So, Dave, you know, you're currently working with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and Medicaid officials to see how this test could be further developed to comply with regulations. Where are you at in the regulatory process?
Yeah, so it was a bit of good news last month when the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services said that universities like ours can perform surveillance non-diagnostic testing like this and can return results back to individuals and refer those individuals for follow-up diagnostic testing. So that clarification was really enabling for us because it means that we now know that we're on solid footing in doing this sort of testing and trying to figure out how to make it so that someone who gets a result from a test like ours can get reflexed over for diagnostic testing at somewhere like the Alliant Energy Center, if you were here in Madison, or other diagnostic testing through your healthcare provider elsewhere in the state.
Your testing has also included athletes at UW-Madison. With the Badger football season returning, how involved do you foresee being, in the testing of players?
Well, that's a great example of where I think things are going to go. So it was announced a couple of weeks ago that the return of Badger football was going to be enabled by daily antigen testing. So these are these tests that I was talking about before the break are going to become more widespread and more available later in the year. And the conference has procured access to those and is going to begin daily testing of the football team with them this week. But those tests weren't available when that announcement was made about 2 weeks ago. So we've been working with the athletic department to do daily testing with our test as a stopgap until those antigen tests become available. And it's that same role that I think we foresee having with schools and other places where you have people living in close and working in close proximity until antigen tests become more widely available nationally.
Let's take a call now. Kenneth is joining us from Janesville this morning. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. Why have you, so to speak, reinvented the wheel in that here in the State Line area? I've been hearing about the University of Illinois test, several months ago, that they've been using that sounds better than what you're talking about. Do you know anything about their test or whatever?
Absolutely. So it's a great question, Kenneth. It's one we get a lot all the time. And the answer is that their test also uses spit as what they test, but that spit gets transported to one of these centralized laboratories that has, millions of dollars of equipment and instrumentation in it. And what they do is they then test the spit with a PCR test, the same sort of PCR test that you would usually give a nasal swab for. So it's a huge advancement because it's a lot easier to give spit twice a week for testing than to have a nasal swab twice a week. But at the back end, that test is still being performed in a fancy molecular biology laboratory. Our testing takes a different approach, which is that we have a simple, low-cost lab that costs less than $5,000 or so to equip. And the lab can be brought to a school. It can be brought to a place that doesn't have one of those fancy molecular biology labs. And you can have lots of these individual pop-up lab testing sites that can perform what is called LAMP testing. That's the sort of amplification technology that we use. And that works, it also amplifies the virus like PCR, but doesn't require the fancy instrumentation. So Illinois' testing program is great. They can test up to 20,000 samples a day in their high-throughput molecular lab, but all the samples go to one place. What we would say is that if we wanted to test 20,000 people a day with this sort of testing, you would set up something like 50 portable pop-up labs in different locations, and each of those labs would test a small number of samples. So they both start with spit, but they look very different when you're trying to set them up to cover a wider geographic area.
We're talking with Dave O'Connor, who is a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW-Madison, as we discuss his work to develop a saliva test for COVID-19. So, Dave, who do you envision who you can train up to run these pop-up testing sites?
So this is also a great question. So we've been so far focusing on having skilled scientists do most of the testing because the first question everyone always asks is, well, is the testing itself accurate? And to get the best sort of accuracy, you want to have people who are really well-trained performing the test. But now that we have you know, a couple of thousand tests under our belt, and we have a pretty good sense for how the assay performs. We want to start training people who are less skilled and figuring out how to get the tests in working well in their hands. So we're beginning to work with undergraduate students from UW-Madison who we've employed to work as part of this project. We're starting to talk more seriously with school nurses and people who are in K-12 learning environments who are not professional scientists. And that's one of the things that we're going to be working on over the next month or so, is trying to see what happens when you task shift this to people who are not scientists or professional scientists most of the time, and figuring out how we need to either change the workflow or change the protocol so that people who are unfamiliar with it can be successful with it as quickly as possible.
And your research team is made up of scientists from UW-Madison's AIDS Vaccine Research Lab, which has studied Zika in the past. How does studying COVID-19 compare to the research, and how does, you know, the research you've done in your lab on AIDS and Zika inform what you're doing now?
Yeah, so this sort of test that we're using right now is the sort of test that in the past we've seen used to diagnose infectious diseases in places like Uganda. Again, because you don't have the laboratory infrastructure necessary to do testing in remote areas or in places that are resource constrained. And I never thought we would find ourselves in a situation where here in the U.S., our diagnostic testing capacity would be so overwhelmed that most people wouldn't have access to enough testing to do things like keep schools safe. I just never imagined it would happen, but here we are, and it's going to be very, very difficult to increase the centralized laboratory capacity because those labs are expensive. They take a long time to build and maintain. And so we said, well, what can we do to create, pop-up testing that looks more similar to what you would do if you didn't have a lot of resources in some of these other resource-constrained settings? And that was the initial catalyst for working on this test, along with some work that came out of Wuhan, China, very early in January, showing that this sort of testing could accurately identified people who were infected with this new virus without all of the overhead that you needed for conventional PCR testing.
Very quickly, in the last few seconds we have together, what do the next few months look like for you? What do you foresee?
I hope we spend more time getting schools familiar with this sort of testing and seeing if we can make going back to school as safe with frequent testing as being home from school without frequent testing.
Dave, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dave O'Connor is a UW-Madison professor of pathology and laboratory medicine, and he's leading a new COVID-19 test, non-diagnostic test, surveillance test with saliva samples. Just ahead, we discuss how an endangered animal could be responsible for bringing COVID-19 to light. A journalist is with us to explain the growing threat of zoonotic diseases. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.